Welcome to the Austin Zaback Show, where every guest is meant to leave listeners inspired and motivated, propelling them to pursue their passions and live up to their full potential.
It was a little difficult out the gate to raise capital just because people were still nervous about the market in general. Basically, buy any house you wanted for $25,000. Now, same house is selling for $250,000, $300,000.
Why hard money?
From the day that we receive the loan request to funding is about 7 days. So think of all the things that you got to give to a mortgage company if you're trying to get a loan. We don't need any of that. Yep. We just look at the asset itself. We've got about 600 investors, average investments around $700,000, put as much of your money as you possibly can in the deal because it just makes people more comfortable.
Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Zaback Show. Today we have Noah Brocious on the show, the president of Capital Fund One, most likely, arguably, the number one hard money company in the state of Arizona, $750 million under management. We actually have got four flips going on with you guys right now of the, I think, eight total that we have going on, looking to get that to all eight here at some point. And Noah, I really appreciate you being on the show. There's a lot I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it, of course. So we were talking a bit before the show. You got into kind of the hard money lending game in about a decade ago, right? Mm-hmm. And one of your good buddies started Capital Fund One. Mm-hmm. You got in there pretty early, basically built it from the ground up. Now you're the president. You're running the show over there. And hard money is such a fascinating game. I haven't actually had any hard money guys on the show. Yeah. So I'm excited to kind of talk to you about the nitty gritty of that world. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. So what were you doing? Like, why did you get into that game? I mean, what were you doing right prior to that?
Yeah. So I graduated college, 2003, long time ago, got into insurance, failed miserably at selling insurance. I quickly found out I wasn't good at talking to people about the last thing in the world they wanted to talk about. So quickly got into real estate, did some land development from about 2004 to 2007. Then had the opportunity to go work for a commercial developer, Panattoni Development, here in town. So I was a development manager there. We developed four industrial projects here in the valley. And then obviously, you know, market kind of melted down. They shut down the office. And I hooked back up with the two guys I was working with from 04 to 07 doing land development. They had started buying properties at the trustee sale auction. And doing fix and flip themselves. Mm-hmm. So I joined back up with them to help them with that. And then we met some investors down at the courthouse steps that needed some capital for some deals. We made a couple loans and then just saw what a demand there was for capital back then. There was a lot of properties to buy, but not much capital available. Mm. So we decided to pivot and focus on the lending business.
Yeah. It's so fascinating, you know, getting into that world. When you're playing, what are the rules and regulations to doing a one-off loan like that? Are there any? I mean, when you're talking like back then when you made your first couple of loans, I mean, it's just one guy giving another guy money, right?
Yeah. So each state's a little different. In Arizona, you are required to be licensed, even if it's not a consumer loan. If it's residential, you're required to be licensed, but the statute state you can do up to five loans a year without being licensed.
Got it. So to be a licensed lender.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So either a licensed mortgage bank or a licensed mortgage broker.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. And then you got into that world, and what was it like in the very beginning? I mean, how did you initially kind of get the ball rolling, right? To obviously you're massive today, but what were that kind of first year or two like? I mean, was it even called Capital Fund One in the beginning?
Yeah, so it was called Post Foreclosure Funding when we first started. And fortunately, the founder, Mike Anderson, had some capital liquid that we were using to do fix and flips. So we had a couple million dollars that we started with. I think we made six or seven loans. Mm-hmm. You know, we felt like the business had legs. So then we created our fund and started reaching out to friends and family. To raise additional capital. And, you know, obviously back in 09, you know, when it seems like when things are bad, people think like they're never going to get better. Mm-hmm. When things are good, people feel like they're never going to go bad.
If you're enjoying the show and you've been enjoying all the incredible guests that we've had on lately, it would mean the world if you would go ahead and leave me a review. All you have to do is scroll to the bottom if you're listening on Spotify or podcasts and go ahead and leave a 5-star review if possible and elaborate on what you like about the show so far. And we'll continue to bring on incredible guests in the future. Thank you so much for tuning in every single week. And let's go ahead and get back to the show.
So it was a little difficult out the gate to raise capital just because people were still nervous about the market in general. But slowly but surely, we were able to raise capital so that we built the fund so that we had a little bit more bandwidth. And then one of the things that really helped us was in 2012, we started working with Western Alliance Bank on a credit facility, and then we were able to close that credit facility in 2013. So that just gave us even more bandwidth.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And back then when you got in, were there a lot of flippers in the market at that time?
Yeah. I mean, there was, I wouldn't say as many as there are today, but there were a lot of folks that, you know, had been flipping when the market was crazy from, you know, call it 04 to, you know, late 06. So a lot of those investors had jumped back in, and then just other opportunistic investors. So, you know, down at the courthouse steps, there was a lot of competition. You know, it's funny to think back, you know, you'd pay $55,000 for a house in Glendale and you'd say, oh man, we really only wanted to pay 50. Did we overpay? Yeah. So it seems silly now because of where values are at. But yeah, there was some decent competition back then.
Yeah, imagine if you would have kept every house that you bought for 50 grand, 55 grand.
I know. I think of like Maryvale.
Yeah.
I mean, from 09, 010, you could basically buy any house you wanted for 25 grand.
Wild.
Yeah. And now same house is selling for 250, 300,000. So yeah, if we all would have just raised $100 million, bought everything we could and held it, probably wouldn't be talking here today.
Hindsight's 2020.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep, hopefully always. You'd still be on the show.
Yeah.
I'd have to get you from the Bahamas or something to fly right. down here, you know?
Yeah.
You know, well, like I had Zachary Keeps on the show, you know, and I've had Doug Hopkins on the show and a bunch of guys. And, you know, Zach, I mean, he bought, to my knowledge, a lot of the properties, you know, in that kind of era that he owns today, you know? And now, I mean, I think his total portfolio, I want to say 70% is owned free and clear, which is wild, you know? Yeah. But I mean, you look at the facts that you just mentioned. I mean, it goes to show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's done well. And yeah, he bought when a lot of other people weren't buying, and he was able to hold a lot of those properties, which has made him real successful.
How did you initially start to raise capital? You talk about it being difficult, right? And people were being, you know, maybe people had the mentality of like you talk, you know, being maybe a little bit frightened or scared by the market, like what could happen, right? What were some of the challenges that you faced and how did you overcome them to raise the capital, you know, slowly but surely?
Yeah. I mean, it was the biggest inhibitor was just nervousness about the market in general. You know, people generally thought we were at the bottom, but you know, there was talks that maybe we'd have a double dip, you know, not really knowing if we were truly at the bottom. So I think most people that, you know, were around and that we were talking to had been burned with some type of investment, and a lot of them in real estate. Mm-hmm. So it was really just, you know, the PTSD that people had just from getting burned. And, you know, unfortunately there wasn't a lot of liquidity at that point in time. So even if somebody had some money to invest, you know, they didn't, you know, have a ton of money. Mm-hmm. So it was, all right, do I want to put my money in this?
Sure. And I guess this is a two-part question. So in the beginning, what was the average investment size? So you start the fund, right? Was there a minimum that people had to invest? And then has that average changed over the years?
Yeah. So when we started our stated minimums, 50,000. Mm-hmm. So people can come in with a smaller dollar amount. Back then when we first started, you know, the average investment was probably 500 to 750,000. Okay. So we were able to bring in some larger investors at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But now we've got about 600 investors. So average investments around 700,000.
Yep.
But it's a little top heavy. One of the things that's helped us raise capital is that there's seven partners in the operating company, myself and Mike Anderson, the founder, and five others. Mm-hmm. And between the seven of us, we have about $65 million of our own personal dollars invested.
Sure.
So, you know, it's a little top heavy,
yeah,
but it's really helped us raise capital because it's not a situation where we say, hey, give us your money. We promise we'll take care of it. It's come invest alongside of us.
Yeah. Which is the ideal way to raise capital, right?
Yeah.
You know, Zach Haptonstall on the show recently, and mm-hmm. he's the owner of Rise 48. Mm-hmm. And he talked about that. You know, I asked him about when he got his first deal under contract mm-hmm. and raising that initial round of capital. And it took him basically going all in mm-hmm. with his own money yep. to get that first person to commit, right? Yep. And nobody was willing to commit until he had, you know, skin in the game.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Skin in the game's most important thing when you're raising capital. Cause I talk to a lot of people that are trying to build a fund and they say, what's the most important thing? I said, put as much of your money mm-hmm. as you possibly can in the deal. Cause it just makes people more comfortable.
Sure. Yeah. So talk to me a bit, you know, maybe for somebody watching, we'll go down the rabbit hole really quick and then come back around. But why hard money, right? Like, mm-hmm. it, you know, if somebody's watching and maybe they're looking into getting into flipping or they mm-hmm. want to, I don't know, they see a good deal on the market or maybe they find an off-market deal. What are the reasons why somebody would purchase a deal with hard money?
Yeah. So Capital Fund One and a lot of other hard money lenders are similar to us in the fact that we're an asset-based lender. So we focus our underwriting on the property or the project versus underwriting the borrower. Mm. So it's a lot different than if you go to a bank or a conventional lender. So for us, and again, a lot of other lenders, we don't check credit. We don't need bank statements. We don't need tax returns. So think of all the things that you got to give to, mm-hmm. You know, a mortgage company if you're trying to get a loan. We don't need any of that.
Yep.
We just look at the asset itself, value the real estate based on what it's worth today, project what we think it's going to be worth, you know, after repair. So we put an after repair value to it and we look at what the borrower is paying for the property and we determine a loan amount based off of those factors.
Yep.
So it allows us to move a lot more quickly. So going back to why somebody would borrow money from us, typically it's one of three reasons. Either they don't have time to close with a bank or a conventional lender. I mean, you know, in this investment world, you got to close quickly if you want to get a good deal. So on average, our loans from the day that we receive the loan request to funding is about 7 days.
That's your average.
Yeah.
Wow.
So no bank or conventional lender could ever do that. Mm-hmm. And the short-term loans, our average loan pays off in about 7 months.
Yeah.
So a bank or a conventional lender, they don't want to go through all the brain damage that they have to put a borrower through to then get paid off in 6 to 7 months.
Sure.
So the main reason is timing. The other reason, again, because we don't focus on the credit of the borrower. If a borrower has a credit issue, it doesn't matter to us. If they have mm-hmm. a 500 credit score, an 800 credit score, it really doesn't matter to
sure.
us. We're, again, underwriting the real estate.
Yep.
And then the third reason is that even if somebody is bankable or if they have time to go to a bank or a conventional source, a lot of them just don't want to deal with the brain damage.
Mm.
You know, they'd rather spend, you know, 5 hours with us getting a loan approved versus 50 to 100 hours mm. with a bank, you know, because time is money. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of time I tell people, yes, our rate's higher, but if you put any value on your time, you know, we might be priced pretty comparatively
sure.
with a bank. And today, obviously the spread between the rate that we're charging and what banks and conventional lenders are charging is a lot thinner mm-hmm. than it's been, you know, in the past couple of years. So yeah, a lot of people come to us for that reason too, just because they want to get a deal done quickly.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You know, and for people watching that maybe would just to go one step deeper, the reason you're able as a hard money lender to underwrite based on the asset, not mm-hmm. the individual, is strictly because you believe in the asset. So mm-hmm. if the borrower doesn't perform on their payment, yep. you believe as the lender that you can take that asset.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you guys as hard money lenders are real estate investors. I mean, technically,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You understand what a piece of real estate will trade for.
Right.
And you understand how much it'll cost to get that piece of real estate in the condition
yep.
where it'll trade at that number, right?
Yeah.
And so you believe in the asset. You believe, hey, yep. if the borrower doesn't pay, we'll take the asset back.
Yeah.
Right? And how often do you guys have to do that?
Yeah. So fortunately, it's not that frequent. So we've originated over 13,000 loans since 2009, and we've had about 90 REO.
Really?
So it's been a really, really low percentage.
What is the, I mean, it's like 0.01?
Yeah.
Hey, really quick, I'm sure you already know, but I've done over 2,500 wholesale deals in my career, and me and my team consistently do anywhere from 1 to 2 wholesale deals a day. If you're looking to get better at wholesaling, or maybe you're brand new, you've never wholesaled a deal, I would actually love to coach you. I would love to mentor you, and I would love for you to be a part of our education program. All you have to do is go to www.flippinsimple.com, or you can find a link in the description down below and book a strategy session with my team to see if you would be a good fit for our coaching program. Again, this is our exact strategy and formula of how we are actually able to go out every single day and do anywhere from 1 to 2 wholesale deals a day. Nobody's talking about what we're doing, and I really look forward to coaching you and mentoring you. So again, go to www.flippinsimple.com. Now let's just go ahead and get back to the show.
Yeah, it's a very small percentage. And one of the big reasons is that, you know, we do require skin in the game from the borrower in the form of a down payment. So, you know, a lot of, you know, as interest rates started to increase, you know, second quarter of 2022 and the market slowed down, there was a lot of borrowers that, you know, kind of relooked at the market and said, all right, I thought I was going to make $100,000 on this deal, but based on where values are trending, I might not make anything on this. Mm-hmm. But because they have their own cash in the deal, you know, they'll have 100, 200, 300,000 or more into the deal. They're going to stick around and see that project through, finish the rehab, sell the property because they want to recoup as much of their capital as possible.
Sure.
So that leads to borrowers not throwing in the towel and letting the property go to foreclosure.
Yeah.
It does, you know, it happens in rare instances, but yeah, I mean, you know, we don't want to own real estate, but we are a real estate company that happens to lend money. Mm-hmm. So we're comfortable if we have to taking a property back and, you know, selling it, either as is or going in and adding some value to sell it, but it's not what we like to do, but we're comfortable with doing it if we have to.
Sure. And can you give me any parameters? I don't know what you can and can't talk about, but what are your underwriters looking for when evaluating a deal, whether or not you would loan on it? So like, you know, if I bring you a deal and the ARV, you know, the after repair value is $250,000, is there a number that I need to purchase that property for that your underwriters are looking at where if I'm overpaying for that deal, you guys are just going to say we won't lend on that deal?
Yeah. So typically when we underwrite a deal, we look at, you know, three factors, what the borrower is paying for the property, what we believe the property's worth in its as is condition, and then what we believe the property will be worth, once the rehab's been done.
Sure.
So, you know, again, we don't underwrite the borrower's credit, but we do look at past experience. So obviously, you know, we're going to be a little bit more comfortable lending to somebody that's done 100 deals versus somebody that's done one deal. So we adjust our risk based on that. Mm-hmm. And then we're obviously going to look at their rehab budget. Mm-hmm. That's going to help us determine, you know, our estimated after repair value. So as far as, you know, a fix and flip deal right now, we'll typically want to lend no more than 90% of the purchase price, as long as that doesn't exceed 85% of the current value.
Okay.
So they need to be buying at a little bit of a discount to current value, and also no more than 75% of the after repair value.
Got it.
So we basically look at those three tolerances and the loan amount. You know, we want to lend as much as we can, but we lend up to where we hit one of those tolerances.
Sure. And what if somebody comes to you, they're watching this right now, they've never flipped a property, they've always wanted to flip a property. They're not somebody like me, you know, where I call Vince or you and I'm like, dude, I've done 3,000 wholesale deals. Like I've flipped hundreds of properties. You guys don't even bat an eye. Right.
Yeah.
But for somebody who's maybe never done a deal, what is the barrier of entry? Like, do they have to be buying a really good deal for their first deal? Like, 'cause obviously you talk about their past experience, right? How can they get past that to get the experience to where they can do more?
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll absolutely lend to people that are doing their first flip. You know, some of the things we look at is, you know, if it's somebody, it's their first flip and they want to demo a portion of the house and do an addition, you know, and it's a big, big project, we're going to be pretty conservative on something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd typically like to see somebody doing a cosmetic remodel on their first deal. Mm-hmm. And then it really, like we've talked about, it comes down to the numbers. If they're making a great buy, there's a lot of spread in the deal. And it looks like it's a profitable deal. We'll definitely make that loan to them, but we're just always going to err a little bit on the conservative side if it's somebody's first deal.
Sure. Yeah. Talk to me about like refinancing, you know, so, I've bought a couple of deals where I bought them hard money. Like I'll give you an example. I bought a deal. Let me think. I bought a deal not too long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, where I bought it with the intention of it being my primary, mm-hmm. but I bought it hard money because I wanted to renovate the property and right. then move into it. Right. Yep. What are the rules and regulations if somebody's watching, you know, and maybe they're looking at the market and they find maybe a good deal where they're like, hey, I'd love to live there as a primary, but obviously I need to do a lot of work to it. Right.
Right.
Are there any rules and regulations just for people watching? So they know, can they buy a deal hard money, renovate the deal and then refinance into a conventional loan, or are there stipulations?
Yeah. So there are some stipulations. So, for us to be an asset-based lender, and not underwrite the borrower and their credit. So basically after the great financial recession, the Dodd-Frank Act got put into place, which stipulated that if a lender's making a consumer loan, so a consumer loan being a property that somebody plans on living in, you have to prove the ability to repay. Mm. So you have to check credit. You have to look at bank statements. You have to look at tax returns to make sure, and you look at debt to income ratio and all those types of things to say, yes, this borrower can qualify for mm-hmm. the loan. So we only lend on non-consumer, non-owner occupied mm-hmm. investment purchases because we're able to be an asset-based lender sure. and not underwrite the borrower. So we do have a document in our loan doc set that the borrower agrees that this is for investment purposes mm-hmm. only. They have no intention of living in the property now or in the future. So, but there are some, you know, private money or hard money lenders out there that will mm-hmm. lend to people that do want to occupy the property. They just have to put that borrower through that process to prove the ability to repay.
Yeah. And so in your situation, they can't even change their mind. Like what if they go in with the intent and they sign that document with it, I'm going to flip it. Right. But then they get done flipping it and they're like, gosh, dang, I really want to live here. Like they're not allowed to change their mind and be like, I want to live here.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to enforce it. Yeah. I mean, I know that we get lied to, you know, on a daily, weekly basis and folks do have the, intention on, mm-hmm. on living there. You know, we try to do as much as we can to make sure that we're not funding loans on properties that are owner occupied or will be.
Sure.
But yeah, it's
you're going to do the best you can.
Yeah, yeah. We do the best we can to protect ourselves. If a borrower changes their mind, refinances us out, it's not an issue.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then I'm curious on the, you know, right now, what are we at? Like an 8%? What is the consumer interest rate right now? 7-8% ballpark?
Yeah, I think it's, right about 8.
How you talked a little while ago about the gap between where the consumer mm-hmm. interest rate is compared to like hard private money, right? Mm-hmm. You know, being, I think at like what, 12, 13, roughly give or take, depending on the deal and everything, right?
Yeah.
How have you been able to maintain that and yet still be profitable? Like, I guess kind of maybe a two-part question would be, when interest rates were 3%, what was your rate at? Mm-hmm. And then I feel like you guys didn't go up at the same level that the rates went up. Like otherwise you guys would be at like what, 15-16%, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A guy texted me the other day and said, hey, what are your rates? And I said, oh, you know, we're in the 11-12% mm-hmm. range. And he said, oh my gosh, rates really went up. And I wanted to say, first of all, have you been in a coma for the past 12 months? Yeah. Second of all, what I told him is when mortgage rates were 3%, we were charging 9-10%. Okay. Now they're, you know, back then it was 7.5 to 8%. We're charging 11-12%. So in my opinion, you're getting a pretty good deal.
You are. And how have you been able to do that?
Yeah. I mean, we do use some leverage, for our fund. So the majority of the capital that we lend has been raised from private high net worth individuals into our fund, but we do have four credit facilities that we use as leverage. Mm. So we've just had to balance, you know, the debt to equity ratio to make sure that we can still give our investors, you know, a competitive yield. So it's, you know, it's looking at what can we pay our investors based on what we're charging. We also have to look closely at the market and competition because, you know, if we went and increased our interest rates to 14-15%, we wouldn't be getting quality loan requests because there's still competitors out there that are lending in the, you know, 11% range.
Sure.
So we kind of have to look at the market, kind of have to look at, you know, what our cost of capital is and what yields we can give to our investors. So it's kind of a fun little financial formula that we play with. Yeah.
Not every hard money lender does draws. Like that, not everyone will fund the rehab, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that you guys are known for funding a rehab and doing draws. And not only that, to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can do unlimited draws with you guys, which I know for a fact other hard money lenders don't do. They'll cap you at like four draws or whatever, right?
Right.
How have you been able to build that out? And does that vary like deal by deal? Is it, or can anybody take advantage of that?
Yeah. So we've built out a good team that handles the loan draw requests. So I think maybe other shops don't necessarily have somebody that's dedicated or a team that's dedicated to that. So they don't want to deal with a lot of loan draws. It's really just based on the system that we've built out, and we want to be flexible for our borrowers. Yeah. I mean, there is a fee associated with a draw because we use a third party inspector to go out there and verify the work's been done. Mm-hmm. So it does end up costing the borrower a little bit more if they request more loan draws. But again, we want to be flexible for folks if they want to request more draws.
Yeah. And how does it work? Like logistically, if somebody's watching, do you write the borrower a check or are you paying the contractor directly?
Yeah, typically, I mean, on larger construction loans, we may pay the general contractor, but typically on a, you know, simple, smaller loan with loan draws included, we'll pay the borrower direct. Yeah. And the way we structure it, we fund as a reimbursement for work that's been completed.
Got it.
So the borrower goes out, you know, does whatever to the property, spends $50,000. We send an inspector out there, verify the work's been done, and then we fund that draw as a reimbursement for that work that's been completed.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
What are some challenges that you've faced in, you talk about like having a great team that handles the draws. Hey, really quick, I don't know if you're aware, but my team and I actually wholesale real estate nationwide. And if you have a deal that you're struggling to sell, I would love to partner with you on it, and I would love to help you sell it. All you have to do is text the number 480-418-5339 and just go ahead and let me know that you have a deal. If you want, you can go ahead and you can send over the information on the deal. If you have the photos of the deal and the deal text, that would all be great. If you don't have that yet, no worries. I will put you in contact with somebody on my team and we will help you move the deal. We have incredible buyers throughout the entire nation. So again, if you're struggling to sell a deal, I would love to partner with you on it. Text 480-418-5339. Now let's just go ahead and get back to the show. Mm-hmm. I think you were saying before the show, you're up to about 75 people on the team now.
Yeah.
What are some big challenges that you faced in growing such a big operation, you know, and hiring people and training and delegating? And I mean, I know, you know, we were talking before the show, I've got multiple companies. I've got right around 70 people total as well. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact, I've had a ton of challenges getting to where I'm at today, but I'd love to hear the challenges that you've had to overcome to kind of get to that scale.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, building out a team can be challenging, especially like I'd say I'm a recovering control freak. So, you know, when we got started, you know, there was four of us and we all kind of had our hands in a little bit of everything. So as you grow, you got to be able to, you know, delegate, put good systems in place to hold people accountable, but ultimately, you know, let go and, mm-hmm. and let people do what they're good at.
Sure.
So, I think, you know, all of us that have been around for a while, we all, you know, have struggled with releasing control a little bit, but I think, like I'm sure you've seen it, once you do release control, put the right people in the right spots, life becomes a lot better because you're not running around like a chicken with your head cut off all day trying to do 72 things at once.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, I mean, it's, but it's been fun. It's fun to, grow things, fun to, you know, build out structure, and then, you know, you never know if it's going to work perfectly, yeah. but like we say, you just got to get the car out of the garage, you know, put things in place and then make adjustments on the fly.
Sure. In order to pay your investors and get them the return that they're looking for, I'd imagine that at any given time, you really need a big majority of your money to be out, right? Mm-hmm. To be loaned out to people, which would, in my mind, mean that you have to be great marketers. Like you have to, you have to be well known. You have to be a desirable product, like in the marketplace, you know? And we were talking before, like you're really good at that. I feel like you host a lot of events and you do a lot of, like, you know, you're very well known, I feel like, especially in the Arizona market, you know? How did you get to that point, you know, as you scaled? I mean, there are other hard money lenders, I feel like, in the space, but they're not nearly as well known as you guys. So like, what did you do? What's kind of that competitive edge that you guys did to kind of get to that level?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, a lot of it was trial and error. I mean, I think about some of the things we used to do, you know, sending out postcards, and we'd go down to the courthouse steps and hand out flyers. And a lot of that worked back then, but just kind of evolving the marketing plan over time. So, you know, now we do, you know, obviously SEO and pay-per-click, things like that. We do a lot of research on the back end to identify, you know, who is an active real estate investor. And then we have a team of loan originators that, you know, are constantly prospecting. So they're following up with existing clients. You know, our marketing team's always putting new leads into our CRM. Mm-hmm. So they're reaching out to new leads. So really it's just kind of dedicating the time and energy and money towards, you know, marketing and business development. And again, trying things out, you know, some things work great, some things don't. So you can eliminate the things that don't and double down on the things that do work.
Yeah. On average, like how many loans do you think you have at any given time? How many flippers or rehabbers or whatever out there doing projects at any given time with you guys?
Yeah, so we've got about 1,900 loans
Wow.
In the portfolio right now.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Does this hover around that number?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, we've grown significantly over the past 3 years. So I'd say 3 years ago, we probably had about 1,000 loans. Okay. So the portfolio's, you know, basically doubled over the past 3 to 4 years.
And if the payoff is averaged every 7 months, then that means, you know, I mean, every week, every month that goes by, you're getting that many new loans, you know, coming through, right?
Yeah, it's constantly on the hamster wheel. Money's going out the door and money's coming back in the door.
Sure. Yeah. What are you seeing in the market right now? You know, we were talking a bit before the show. We've got an election coming up, depending on when people are watching right now.
Yeah.
We're filming actually on Halloween right now, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got an election coming up in what? Well, gosh, I guess about a year. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the market going? You know, what would your advice be to flippers out there right now? You know, I think there's a lot of people that are afraid in the market.
Yeah.
What would you have to say to those people?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's not the time to be overly aggressive, but, you know, kind of the Warren Buffett take on things, you know, when other people are scared or not doing it, a lot of times it's a good time to be doing what other people are scared of. I mean, I think obviously with interest rates higher, there's not as many transactions going on, but there's also very limited supply.
Sure.
And like we were talking about, you know, a lot of the stuff that is on the market isn't turnkey move-in ready. And the, you know, the days of people wanting to buy a you know, a DIY project, you know, there's still some people out there that want to buy a house and they want to fix it up themselves. But that's definitely the minority. Mm-hmm. So most people do want a turnkey move-in ready property. So I think there is still a lot of opportunity for flippers.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I think a lot of people got spoiled in, you know, late 2020, 2021. You could really just buy anything, do an adequate job on the remodel. You know, from the time you bought it to when you sold it, you'd already seen 5 to 10% appreciation. And there was limited inventory. So, you know, a lot of times the profit occurred purely from the appreciation and the bidding wars.
Yeah.
That's
not
obviously,
the skill of the investor.
Exactly. And that's definitely not the case anymore. So you definitely got to buy right. I mean, I think you got to pay close attention to, you know, that neighborhood or the pocket you're in. You got to look at inventory. You know, if inventory is higher in that area, that's something I would shy away from. I think one thing we're doing on loans that we're looking at, if it's in secondary or tertiary markets, we're staying pretty conservative.
Yeah.
So I think you got to stay close to the urban core where there's a bigger buyer pool.
Sure.
Yeah. So,
because you were saying even a little while ago, like sub 500, 600, and then multi-million.
Yep.
And there's kind of that 600 to like million or million two or whatever, that is kind of a weird market. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's typically the move up price range. And obviously like everybody's talked about, people have the golden handcuffs of a, you know, plus or minus 3% interest rate. So unless somebody absolutely has to sell, chances are they're not going to sell a house with a 3% rate and trade into a 8% interest rate. Now, obviously in Arizona and other growth markets, you still have in-migration. Mm-hmm. So you have people moving here, you know, because they wanted to leave wherever they were, or they got a job or whatever. So there are still some buyers in that, you know, kind of move up price range, but the buyers that are here locally, you know, again, there's not a ton of activity in that price range. So yeah, it feels like sub 600 and, you know, over 1.5 million, there's a little bit more activity going on.
Yeah. And I totally agree. I think that, you know, we're, like I told you, we're flipping quite a few again right now, and we're really focusing on sub 500. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing, I mean, I'm already looking at days on market, and I'm looking at everything in the pockets of where we're buying. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing really vacant remodeled. I mean, to your point a little while ago, I mean, you've got a bunch of dated inventory on the market. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the majority of the people are frozen in place with the golden handcuffs. I mean, they can't do anything.
Right.
And those are the people that would theoretically have the product that the buyers are looking for, but they're not going to sell.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think my kind of prediction is that flippers will actually do, again, assuming they buy them right in the right area, over the next, you know, couple of years, they'll do really well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing is, you know, obviously, you know, interest rates are plus or minus 8% right now. And people have speculated that the market's going to be in gridlock until mortgage rates get down to, you know, plus or minus 5%. But if you think about the fact that a lot of people bought homes over the past 2 to 3 years quickly. So because the market was so hot, a lot of people had to waive inspections. They had to waive appraisal contingencies. So, you know, I would argue there's a lot of people in houses today that they don't really love, because they didn't get an inspection and all of a sudden they got in there and there's all these things wrong with the property that they couldn't identify by just walking through it. So my prediction or my feeling is that once mortgage rates get back to, you know, kind of 6.5%, I think a lot of those people that have a 3 or 3.5% rate that really don't like their house will say, all right, close enough. I got to get out of this house. I want to sell. So I don't think rates are going to have to come back, you know, back to plus or minus 5%. So, you know, who knows? My crystal ball is foggy on when rates are going to come down.
If you had to try to predict it, and I know you don't have the crystal ball, do you think going into the election they'll come back down?
I mean, you know, I have a feeling that the Fed will be getting some pressure. You know, supposedly the Fed's an independent agency. We all know it's not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, I mean, we just had a meeting with Western Alliance Bank. And you know, we've talked to some experts, and it was interesting. Western Alliance kind of feels the same way we feel. We feel there's going to be another rate increase this year, just because the, you know, GDP numbers came in higher than projected. So they got to continue to try to slow down the economic growth. So I think there'll be one more, you know, 25 basis point increase this year. And then I think, you know, sometime second, maybe late second quarter, we see one decrease and then maybe another decrease. So maybe two rate decreases. But the thing that's interesting is historically the spread for mortgage rates over the 10-year is about 150 basis points. So right now the 10-year is a little bit over 5%. So basically the spread is double right now just because of the uncertainty in the market. So once, so basically if people felt that things were normal and there wasn't so much uncertainty and that spread came back to, you know, that historic 150 basis point spread, mortgage rates come back to about 6.5%.
Without the 10-year even changing.
Without the 10-year changing. Mm. So, you know, again, my crystal ball's foggy. Yeah. I don't know when the uncertainty is going to be out of the market. But I think like we were talking about, I think after the election, everybody knows kind of what we're dealing with. I think that spread will start to shrink. So even if the 10-year doesn't come down significantly, I think we'll get closer, you know, maybe, I don't know, beginning of 25, sometime in 25, maybe mortgage rates are back in the 6% range.
Sure. And then one more crystal ball prediction. Yeah. What do you think going into, like, you know, 5 years after that? You know, we were talking a bit before the show, 2028, 930, you know, I mean, I feel like we haven't had a big, I mean, we're in a weird market right now. Don't get me wrong, but we haven't had this big, like, crash necessarily in well over a decade to from what I can tell. I mean, do you think we're headed in that direction eventually?
I mean, I've read and listened to a lot of economists, well-respected economists, and it seems like most of them are predicting.
If you want access to the assignment contracts that we use every single day in our wholesaling business, and even our purchase contracts that we use every single day to wholesale anywhere from 30 to 50 houses a month, then go to www.austinzabackfree.com/contracts. Again, austinzabackfree.com/contracts to get all the purchase contracts and all the assignment contracts that we use every single day in our wholesaling business. Now let's go ahead and get back to the show.
You know, kind of 2028 to 2030, some type of major, you know, either U.S. or global issue with the economy. So who knows? Who knows if they're right or not, but better to, you know, hope for the best and plan for the worst. So I think, you know, as things normalize, you know, maybe things get a little bit more normal in 2025, not as crazy as they were in late 2021, early 22, but we have more of a normal market. I think that's kind of the time to make hay while the sun's shining, because we may have some issues as we get closer to 2030.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that the day eventually will have to come. Who knows when?
Yep.
I mean, history repeats itself. So,
And
in your opinion, the best way to prepare is just make as much money as you can.
Yep.
Be somewhat liquid, right?
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Don't spend everything you make. I mean, we all know it, but it's hard when things get hot. You know, everybody thinks it's going to go on forever. So, just tighten up your belt before you need to tighten up your belt.
Sure.
And have cash available.
Yeah.
Because there will be some good opportunities whenever we have more of a major correction.
Sure. And then personal question, because we always got to do that. But at the end, how do you juggle everything? You know, I mean, you've got a family, I'd imagine.
Yep.
You know, a lot of entrepreneurs have sat in that chair. I always like to ask, like, you know, a lot of them have been in the valley before, right? They've, including myself, you know, we've been so achievement driven that we neglect our health, we neglect our family, we screw everything all up.
Yeah.
In the pursuit of that, have you been able to kind of manage and what are you doing in this season of life to kind of juggle everything?
Yeah. I mean, my new motto is, if it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no. So I'm trying to be better about saying no to things that, you know, aren't a hell yes. Cause I do, I've got a wife, I've got a son. I'm on a local charity board, Valley Guardians. So that takes some time. Great group. Have a lot of fun. I'm in the Arizona chapter of YPO. So I've got YPO events and forum meetings on a monthly basis. So it's really just, you know, before I make a decision on something that comes up, I try to take a step back and say, okay, Is this really something I should be spending my time on? Because that's, you know, that's the most valuable, you know, commodity we have is time.
And
you want to make sure that you're using it wisely. But also, like you said, you got to take care of yourself too.
I mean,
I'm pretty, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, exercising and diet and all that kind of stuff, because I want to be healthy. I don't want to live forever. I just want to be healthy for a very long time.
Sure. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more, man. So powerful too, for people watching, you know, like I feel like we all at some point in our life screw that all up.
Oh yeah.
And then we learn the hard way, you know? And I feel like I've definitely already screwed it up in my life, you know, just again, putting money before everything and then you neglect everything else and you know, the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Falls apart if you do that, you know, eventually, right?
Exactly.
So really powerful there. I know we'll get you out of here soon. So kind of final thing, if you were to give the kind of question would be, if you were to give everybody kind of one piece of advice, and it might be your new motto that you talked about, it might be something different. Mm-hmm. Maybe you said you have a son, right? Mm-hmm. You were to leave him with kind of one piece of life advice, something you've learned, some piece of wisdom that you've gathered in your life. It could be financially, just life in general, relationally, whatever it might be. But you could leave kind of one piece of advice behind that people would maybe know you for as a piece of wisdom. What would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the biggest thing and what's made our business successful, and I think what's, you know, made me successful in life is just when you say you're going to do something, do it. Mm. And don't overpromise and undercommit. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of times I get frustrated with people when they set this self-imposed deadline. Mm. They say, hey, I'll get that to you by Wednesday. And they don't. It's like, you committed to doing it. Why am I having to follow up with you? Mm. So I think, you know, it just makes people trust you more. If you stick to what you say you're going to do, and it's really simple, but unfortunately a lot of people don't do it. So it's just really holding yourself accountable to the commitments that you've made.
I love that. Yeah. And you end up, having a lot more self-love and compassion for yourself too, when you keep commitments, you know, I've been on kind of a self-love journey for a little while. And I know that the more promises that you keep, the more you can actually look at yourself in the mirror and be proud of who you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. You don't feel guilty about letting people down.
Yeah. Really powerful.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you being here, Noah. I know you're a really busy guy, so I appreciate you sharing all the value with my audience.
Yeah.
Where can people find you in particular? And then how can they get a hold of Capital Fund if they want to do a deal with you guys?
Yeah. So Capital Fund, the best thing to do is go to the website, CapitalFund1.com. As far as me, you know, you can shoot me an email, Noah@CapitalFund1.com.
Cool.
I'm not overly active on social media, but I've got a LinkedIn account, so you can find me there.
Cool.
If you need to get a hold of me there.
I appreciate that. And I'll put all that information down below so everybody can find it. And I really appreciate you taking the time and being here on the show.
Yeah, this is fun. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Hey, thank you so much for watching. If you're still watching on YouTube, do me a huge favor. Subscribe if you haven't already. Comment down below, like the video. It would mean the world to me. It would help the channel out a ton. If you're listening on any platform, leave a review. Drop a comment down below. Definitely go check out Noah. I would greatly appreciate that. And we'll see you in the next one. Just like that.
Awesome.